Hi, and welcome back to the Unconventionalist Podcast. I'm your host, Mark LaRouste, and this is a show about what it's really like to turn your message into a movement. Now, before I begin, I wanted to wish you a very happy new year. This is the first episode of 2022. It's been a little while. I've been in hibernation mode, and I'll tell you that a bit more in a second. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for joining us. And if you're a usual suspect, then it's always great to have you back and appreciate your attention. Now, one of the reasons why I've been in monk mode is that I have been deep into writing my new book that, unless you've missed the announcement that I made over on social media, that I've had the pleasure and honor to be signed up with the publisher and imprint of Hachette UK with John Murray Learning, which is exciting, but also brought up all sorts of feelings of inadequacy and fear. And if you haven't heard my episode yet with Emily Gindelsberger and Tucker Max, go and check those out. I'll make sure to link them in the show notes where we talked a bit more about that journey and process. But the short version is that it has brought up all this stuff, right? And I'm super passionate about this topic. I really want to make sure that this is the best book I can write. And yet I have these feelings that it's rubbish, that no one's going to care about this, that it's been all said and done before. Like, all these conversations that I've heard over and over again from my clients and some of my guests. And so I wanted to dive into this topic, this idea, right, which was first coined as the imposter phenomenon and the imposter syndrome. And what is imposter syndrome? What is it not? Because I think it's been bastardized over the years, as a lot of people have talked about, that it almost has become this topic that nobody really knows what it is. And so thanks to Graham Alker, a friend who has also been on the podcast, who put on my radar Dr. Valerie Young. She is to imposter syndrome what Brené Brown is to vulnerability. Her book, The Secret Thoughts of Successful Women, Why Capable People Suffer from the Imposter Syndrome and How to Thrive in Spite of It, has been one of my favorite reads of 2021. It's one of these life-changing books that, for me personally, taught me a lot about myself, but also helped me to accept a lot of who I am and how I show up in the world. And I know a lot of people who I've spoken to, especially in with my clients and people part of this community, where you might feel as though actually you're not suffering from imposter syndrome or having an imposter moment, as you'll hear Dr. Valerie Young talk about. But actually, what I learned from this book and what I learned from the conversation you're about to hear is that one of the coping mechanisms with dealing with imposter syndrome is flying under the radar, is trying to make sure that you don't stand out so that you can play it safe and that there's nothing to lose. So if you want to make sure that 2022 is the year that you start showing up more powerfully in your community, at work, and with your friends and family, if you want to find out what might be getting in your way and what to do about it, then I'm so honored and excited to introduce you to my conversation with Dr. Valerie Young, who is not only the author of this amazing book, but is also the co-founder of the Imposter Institute. And I really recommend you go and check out the book, go and check out the website. But more importantly, sit back, take some notes, pay attention, because this might be the conversation that you've been waiting for to kick off 2022 the way that it should be, with a bang. I'll see you in there. Dr. Valerie Young, thank you so much for joining me today. I very much appreciate you taking out the time out of your schedule.
I'm thrilled to be here, Mark.
So where are you in the world? Which part of the world are you in now?
I am in Western Massachusetts. I'm about 3 hours north of New York City and 2 hours west, if that kind of locates people.
Yeah. Yeah. And just something, like, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who's American, and we were having a chat, and she was like, oh, it's just like an 8 hour drive away, that I could do that easily. And for us Europeans, at least in the UK, that sounds like a really long time. But is that true that in America, it seems like distances are slightly different than in the UK? Like, for like a 3 hour drive is not that much of a big deal?
I don't think a 3 hour drive is that much of a big deal, but it's different in different parts of the country. You know, some people would say, well, how far away is it? And you'd say, well, it takes you 2 hours. You go, how many miles? How many kilometers? But if you're in Boston, to go, you know, 10 miles could take 3 hours.
Yeah.
But where I live, going 10 miles would take, you know, 20 minutes. Not 20
that.
Minutes, but a lot less time.
Yeah, I get that. Well, look, I'm really excited to talk to you. And I'll be honest, like, I'm slightly weirdly grateful that we had to reschedule about a week after, because I got to finish your book. And as someone who's dyslexic, who reads really slowly, and who after reading your book clearly ticks in a lot of the boxes. Like, I needed to make sure I came across as competent on this conversation with you that I did my research. But it's, jokes aside, it's a really important book. And I know I've heard you say this before, that you're not the hugest fans of titles, of the title.
Yeah.
And I've been actually recommended to a lot of people, including men, saying it's, I know it's written for women in mind, but actually men can really benefit from it too.
Oh, thanks for saying
that. And I had a ton of questions, a bunch of questions, and especially in the line of writing my book at the moment and having this conversation with you is perfect timing. One of the things, and I know I've heard a lot of your podcast interviews and done a lot of research. I know you get these questions asked a lot, but I'll try and phrase it slightly differently. The imposter phenomenon that first came out in 1978, if I'm not mistaken, it seems like it's slightly evolved over the years. And I've even heard the term, someone saying imposter syndrome has now been bastardized, for whatever term or fact that is, in terms of it's become like the end all and be all for all limiting beliefs and self-doubt. But I wanted to hear in your words, just to dive a little bit deeper, how do you separate imposter syndrome with your absolutely normal, ordinary fear or doubt? What's the distinction for you?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mark. I think the distinction, if you go with the, you know, pure understanding or definition of what imposter syndrome is, it's this persistent pattern of dismissing your accomplishments, you know, and abilities, right? And discounting them and chalking them up to external factors and this fear of being found out. But you're absolutely right. You could certainly have very normal fears. I mean, I think people need to normalize self-doubt and fear, because we have this false idea that if I was really competent, I'd be confident 24/7. And that's not true. I mean, Denzel Washington, before he walked out, you know, on Broadway in Fences, when he's standing in the wings, he said, if you don't have that, what the hell am I doing here moment, it's time to hang it up. So you're right. Not all fear or self-doubt is imposter syndrome. And not all examples of inauthenticity are imposter syndrome. And I see that being thrown around as well.
So how did, and that's exactly it, because I think in, you know, just to give you a bit of a background, when I pitched the book to my publisher, and I'm going to be completely honest, I hadn't come across your work yet. Your work was shared with me after having spoken a bit more about the book topic I'm writing about. And then I thought, how did I not hear about you? I kind of introduced you as the you are to imposter syndrome what Brené Brown is to vulnerability. And I feel like you're that kind of the go-to that I should have known about. But the way that I pitched it to the publishers, and when I was talking about it, was I know so many entrepreneurs and business leaders and business owners in that kind of sphere who aren't putting themselves out there and their work more because of a few reasons. One of them is fear. One of them is confidence. And another one is an ROI issue. But I just wasn't sure if that fell into imposter syndrome. And the reason why I say this is that when I spoke to clients and potential readers about it, they didn't associate with the word imposter syndrome. And I wonder if imposter syndrome has almost become like mental health. Like, there's a stigma attached to it now, that if you say to someone like, oh, you might be experiencing imposter syndrome, they might be thinking that you're telling them that you've got confidence issues. So I guess that'll be the first part. Have you felt that there's been a collapse maybe in the stigma around the word?
I actually think the stigma is less than it used to be, because there is so much more conversation going on about it. So you're seeing many more senior leaders in organizations talking about it in a very offhanded, matter of fact, you know, kind of normalizing kind of way, which I think is important because it takes the shame out of it. You know, I still think, you know, for some, I think specifically men, you know, there's more vulnerability in the culture for men talking about feelings, but I see men talking about it a lot more. Years ago, I was interviewed by Inc. magazine, which is like the top 500 most rapidly growing, you know, businesses in the US. And they were trying to write a piece on imposter syndrome, and they could not find a man in the Inc. 500, you know, category who would admit to imposter syndrome. So they reached out to me to find somebody. Today, I don't think they'd have a problem finding that person. So I actually think that there's less stigma. But I want to go back to your point for a minute, because I think you're right. I think everything suddenly is imposter syndrome. I was I did a webinar for a university, and I was explaining that I did this 6-minute TED talk at TED headquarters.
Yeah, it's great.
It was the most intense experience of my life, and I spent hundreds of hours, you know, writing it, practicing it, timing it, because they only gave us 6 minutes, and all the big TED people were there. Chris Anderson, I mean, everybody was in the audience. It was very intense. And afterwards, I mean, I was disappointed because, you know, if you're a speaker, you know what it's like, or any job really, you know what it's like to step away and go like, I nailed it, right? To have that like incredible feeling of like, nailed it. And I didn't have that feeling. So somebody on the call said, oh, you had imposter syndrome. I said, no, I was disappointed, but I didn't feel like I was a fraud. I didn't feel like I fooled anybody. I wasn't discounting any of my past accomplishments or my abilities. I was disappointed.
Yeah.
And we can be crushingly disappointed, but not ashamed or not feel like an imposter. And I expect to feel disappointed, and that's okay.
Yeah. And I just want to differentiate between I was disappointed with the pattern that I know you talk about in your book, which can sometimes be your standards of excellence are so high that you can never meet that standard. And therefore anything you do will always be short of. And so you walk away saying, yeah, that just wasn't good enough, which I have. Like, I will walk off stage and I will tell you all the things that I forgot to mention, all the things that I wish I'd said differently. First and foremost, before I go into the list of like, hey, I want to celebrate this and X, Y, and Z. So you're saying there's a difference between those two.
Yeah, I think so. And I know what you're describing very well. I used to do that a lot. But I think the more I hear myself talk about solutions to imposter syndrome, I'm more quickly able to kind of talk myself down. And so I now know that I did a 5-city tour in British Columbia for this entrepreneurial thing, women's entrepreneur thing. And every event was different. It was the exact same workshop, but every audience was different. And sometimes they were like bouncing off the walls. They were so excited. Other audiences were sitting there with their arms crossed. And it would have been easy for me to take that personally. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't. It's like someday, you know, I mean, different audiences, you might forget something. Did it change things? I mean, I've had screw ups with technology and stuff that happens. And I've learned to let it roll off me more and to learn from it more quickly and keep going.
Yeah. And I want to point something to our audience. When you say talk down from, I've heard you say this a lot, and I'm going to make the assumption that what you mean is that if you're stuck in this kind of imposter feeling moment, to talk yourself down from that tree of panic of like, come back down and let's rationalize. And that's what you mean, right? When you say talk yourself down.
Yeah, exactly. So I think of it as kind of standing on this cliff, right? So you're on the imposter cliff, right? And so instead of having an imposter life, you can have an imposter moment.
Yeah.
You know, you can work. So, you know, and I think it's important people to know that, because we have this notion that I'm going to read a book or I'm going to hear a talk or go to a workshop and it's going to like cure me.
Fix. Yeah.
And feelings are the last to change. So don't be surprised if you're the only woman of color sitting in a big meeting, right? That you might have this imposter experience. But just again, have the tools so that when you have what would be a normal imposter moment, to be able to talk yourself down more quickly and give yourself a reframe, another way to look at this, at what's going on.
I'm smiling because I just remembered the story that I've heard you share a few times about when you first came across, you know, the imposter phenomenon, and then you and your peers started almost like a support, you know, imposter support group. And after all, speaking about your feelings of what you experiencing, you suddenly looked around and go, oh, wait a minute, but they're all lying. I'm the only imposter in this room.
Right. Even though everyone else was saying they were an imposter, right? I knew I was the only real imposter. I always share that story at universities, Mark, and I'm often speaking to large audiences of like 300 PhD students. And I say that because I know they're looking around and going, they all say they are, but I really am. So I always tell them, you're like the Beyonce of imposter syndrome. You're like a super imposter.
Yeah. And so just to circle back to that, because again, I think this is one of the juiciest morsels I really wanted to kind of get your take on. It's this distinction between, because I've heard people tell me like, oh no, I don't have imposter syndrome. Like, I know I'm good at what I do. Because a lot of the times when I see imposter being used in professional setting and sometimes in business entrepreneurship, it's like an inability to truly own our skills and to internalize that instead of externalizing and giving excuses to say like, oh no, I got lucky. It was given to me. They were just being generous. You know, you're just saying that to be nice, blah, blah, blah. Versus, oh no, I don't want to put myself out because I'm scared of what people will say. Does that make sense? So would you, I know my brain's a little bit tangled because I'm so deep in this topic at the moment. Mm-hmm. It's just, I'm trying to figure out where does imposter syndrome fit in the narrative, at least of the book that I'm trying to explain to people. Is it when they go, oh, I'm not putting myself out there maybe because who am I to talk about this? Despite having like evidence to the contrary of their accolades and achievements, right? That's one of them. Versus, oh, I'm afraid that if I put myself out there, I'll open myself up for criticism.
Well, I don't think it's either or. I think it can be both. You know, for some people, there is this notion that, you know, there's always one more book to read, one more class to take, one more degree to get, right? This endless pursuit of the end expert. Of knowledge. Mm. And like, who do you think you are to put yourself out there and say you're whatever? So there's definitely that. Mm. But on the other hand, what was the second part? So both of our brains are scrambled today.
No. So the reason why, because again, I wanted to be really mindful about how I use imposter syndrome in the book and how I talk about it.
Right.
And so when I first approached the topic, it was helping entrepreneurs overcome imposter syndrome. That was kind of like the pitch of the book, right? But what I quickly realized was that some people didn't associate themselves with imposter syndrome. So they wouldn't be in the market to look for a book to solve imposter syndrome.
Right.
The second thing was that they didn't feel like what they lacked of was their confidence and their ability, because they knew they were good at what they did. They knew they got results for their clients, but they were so afraid to put themselves out there for the world to judge, see, whatever you want. And that's where I wasn't sure where that fitted, if it was just a fear of fear or.
Well, I mean, for some people, that could be, you know, I refer to it as kind of flying under the radar in the book. You know, there's certain kind of coping and protecting mechanisms that, and that's a term by Pauline Clance and Suzanne Imes, the psychologist who coined the term. Mm. You know, these different ways that we've learned to behave unconsciously to both manage the anxiety of, you know, waiting to be found out and also to avoid being found out. So for some people, it's kind of head down, you know, kind of play small. Don't speak up in a meeting. Don't put my ideas out there. Don't scale my business, because the more I put myself out there, the riskier it is. You know, there's farther to fall. There's more scrutiny. And if I'm feeling like I'm going to be found out, that's problematic. But there, you know, I always hesitate to diagnose anybody and say, oh, that means you have imposter syndrome. It might be that they are a enormous introvert. It might mean that they are afraid of the consequences of success. Like if I become this big thing, like what is the impact that's going to have on my life?
Yeah.
Let me just speak personally. Like I don't want to build an empire. You know, I've had two businesses. One I sold a couple of years ago, which could have been much bigger, but I've never wanted to manage an empire. I've never
was that changecourse.com? Was that the one that you did Change Course, or was that another
changingcourse.com?
Changingcourse.com, yeah.
Yep. But I never wanted to have an empire. I left a corporate job because I didn't want that kind of infrastructure and hierarchies and layers of management and you know, an HR department and all that kind of stuff. So somebody could look at that and go, oh, you're afraid. It's like, no, I'm really clear on what I wanted my life to look like.
There was so many elements of your book, and you know, and I wanted to thank you personally for that, because there's so many elements of your book that enabled me to understand a little bit better why I acted the way I am, and also have a bit more compassion for me. I think a big theme that actually came out, I don't know if that was an underlining tone for you, was having a bit more compassion and empathy for why I did certain things. So, for example, when you just talked about the coping mechanisms that certain people with imposter syndrome use, it was one of the most uncomfortable parts of the book. Because as I was reading, I was like, you said at one point, tick which one you think is most, but I was like, tick, 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 tick.
That just means you're really taking care of yourself, Mark.
Yeah, right. So speaking of that, you talk about this at some point. You talk about how actually pay attention to the thing that you've developed to protect you, because it actually serves a purpose. It's trying to protect you. It's not trying to destroy you. I know that sounds counterintuitive for people listening, but can you say a bit more about that?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the reason why we develop dysfunctional patterns, whether it's about imposter syndrome and relationships or what have you, is, you know, again, we're trying to take care of ourselves in some way. So I would invite people to think about, and let me just run through some of the coping mechanisms. So it might be that notion of holding back, flying under the radar. It could also be chronically procrastinating on important things. I mean, we all procrastinate. We're all hardwired to avoid things that are big, difficult, challenging, not fun. But if we, you know, if we have to develop this presentation, right, we're going after venture capital and we have to make this big pitch and we keep procrastinating writing it or preparing it. And then we don't get the money and it's reflected in our effort. We have this built in excuse. Right. But if we did 100%. Get the venture capital, then we say, fool them again. And they're going to quickly find out. I don't know what I'm talking about. It could be never starting or finishing the business plan, the degree, the book, the painting, or overworking, over preparing. And I don't mean like good old fashioned hard work, but the sense that this belief that I have to work harder than everyone else to cover up for my supposed ineptness. So the questions I would invite people to ask themselves, and these come from Dr. Gerald Weinstein, by the way, from University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He's retired now. And the questions are like, what does my pattern help me avoid? Mm. What does my pattern protect me from? And what does my pattern help me get? Because it's there to serve you. So if you work crazy hard all the time, you're probably going to be successful. Hard pattern to break. If you procrastinate, you get time to do stuff you'd rather do. You know, flying under the radar or different forms of self-sabotage, it helps you avoid disappointment, humiliation, stress, failure, of course. So you're getting something, but that you have to ask the next set of questions, which is like the good news is it works. The bad news is it works because always at a cost, right? Yeah. We pay a price for the protection that we get from our pattern. So now you want to ask yourself, like, what will happen if I never change this pattern? What price will I pay and what opportunities and experiences will I miss out on? So once you realize what you're paying, then now you can make a conscious decision because before it was an unconscious pattern. But now you can say, well, I'm going to keep my lousy imposter pattern because it's protecting me so far. Or you decide the price is too high.
I love that. I love that because as I was reading that, I was like, yeah, I do all this even for this interview, right? Like I listened to maybe 4 or 5 hours of podcasts. I read your book. I watched your TED. Like there's just so much content because I wanted to make sure that I was well prepared, right? Like, but what I realized, I was reading this and people listening to this maybe can recognize this. It's almost smoke and mirrors. It's like, as long as I can control your attention and I can control what you see, then I'm safe. Does that make sense? Because, for example, for me, you know, as I was going, you know, your book and therapy and all these kind of different stuff that I've been doing of this, I've realized that, you know, when I was a small child, I was in school and I'm dyslexic and all this stuff. So I couldn't spell and I couldn't read out loud very well. So I was made fun on a permanent basis and bullied by my French teachers. And so that left a deep kind of wound around I'm inadequate, right? I'm not enough. But what's interesting is that for me, I turned that into an internalization that I need to prove the world wrong. And so that fuel enabled me to go to university, get a good degree, get a good job, you know, start business, all this stuff, like quote unquote, appearing to be successful, but never deep down feeling like as such.
Right.
And there's a line in your book, which I'm going to get framed somewhere, which I think it's from the Cool Runnings, the film. And it says something like, if you're not enough before the gold medal, you won't be afterwards, which effectively says, if you don't feel like you're enough before you win the gold medal, like forget about the gold medal changing the way you feel. Right. Have you found in your 40 years, almost your 4 decades of research and work around this, that imposter syndrome can also be linked to some childhood trauma or some event that's happened around making you feel a certain way and that you've carried that with you up until maybe now?
Sure, absolutely. I think we have to look in a number of different places. There's no one source. You know, I talk about kind of 7 perfectly good reasons why someone might feel like a fraud. And one of them certainly is messages you got growing up. So I was doing a webinar for Microsoft and someone put in the chat, an employee, she's Indian from obviously American, but from India. And culturally in her family, she said, if you're average, the message is don't come home. And she did a little LOL, but I knew it wasn't a joke, right? That very strong pressure to excel, or similarly to your situation on the reverse, right? If you if you struggled academically for whatever reason, right, now this need to kind of prove to people that you can do it. Or sadly, some people give up, right? And they don't try. They internalize those messages of you're dumb, you're stupid, you can't do it. Other children get kind of over praised. They're told everything they did was remarkable. So there's many variations on a theme, and there's different ways that can play out for people. I often ask my audiences, how many of you have exceeded your family's expectations? I mean, because if you think about, like, how was success defined in your family? In one family, it might be all my kids are going to stay alive, right? Another one, all my kids are going to go through high school, secondary school. Another family, it's my kids are going to go to college, the university. Another family, it's they have to go to the right university. And another family, they have to go to the right university and get the right degree. And another family might have not to do with academics at all. It's going into the military. That's the family tradition, or going into the family business, or whatever, producing a bunch of grandchildren. So, but the question I ask people is, do you feel like you've exceeded your family's expectations, which I certainly did, or fallen short of your family's expectations? And either one will send you into therapy.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah. 100%. 100%. And there's something about that, which I thought was also really interesting in your work around, I know it's obvious, but it's looking at our definition of success, looking at what our interpretation of success is. And I wonder if there's something around that we can talk about around how can we change. And I'll use myself as an example, because I know people, will have their own various example. For me, I've got this thing in my head that unless I build a seven-figure business, right, if I don't hit the six-seven-figure business, then it's a waste of time. If I can't provide for my family, then I'm lesser of a man. I'm a failure of a man. Like, I have these patterns, and I know intellectually, like, I can talk to you and say, I know that's crazy, I know that's, but it still drives me.
Sure.
What are some ways that we can look at changing our definition of success, or really revisiting that relationship with?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of, in terms of just kind of career planning, if you will, is the life first, work second approach, is to kind of figure out what do you want your life to look like first, and then come up with ways to generate income that's going to allow you to have as much of that life as possible. So if your idea of, kind of heaven on earth is working, living, half the year in Italy or in Portugal or, on some tropical island, and the rest of the time in the UK, or working part time or having summers off.
Are you saying the UK is not a tropical island, Valerie?
Yes, you're right. It is a tropical island. But, to kind of think about that's how I knew I didn't want to build an empire. So I think, especially if you're in a relationship, then you both have to have that conversation about, what does success mean and at what cost? Because the reality is there's very few situations where, at least for a big chunk of time to build something, it's going to take more time. And so that's time not doing other things with family, with children, exercising or what have you. So you just have to make decisions around the trade-offs. There's no getting around entrepreneurially that you're working really hard.
Yeah. No, that 100%.
It's to build your own thing.
Yeah. And it was interesting because I heard you talk about with Johnny Dumas, I think it was, I managed to dig out like an old podcast interview. And am I right in saying that you used to commute 90 miles a day to go to your corporate job when you work?
Well, it was 45 miles each way. So
45. Yeah. 90 miles a day. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah, so it was an hour each way.
Yeah. And I heard you talk about a story that you'd come up with a side business of drawing or creating greeting cards.
Yes.
Was that, but that, and again, you tried it and then you realized that, the business of actually having to follow up and making sales calls wasn't so much what you wanted, but it was like an experience in trying something that didn't work out. And
right. And I'm really glad I did it. Cause then I learned. I'm really glad I did it, but I think you have to try things and see how it works and not, I always don't invest huge sums of money until you know that you want to do something.
Yeah.
And people do that with their careers all the time. I would say to people, so you're miserable. Why did you become an engineer or a pharmacist or whatever? And they say, well, because when I was young, everyone said I was good at, X, Y, and Z. You know, and but nobody ever says, what do you want your life to look like? They just ask you, what do you want to be when you grow up? But I mean, it's, my niece wanted to be a pharmacist, and all I could picture was standing under fluorescent lights all day, standing on your feet. Right? I mean, it makes very good money, but I go right to like the, what does the lifestyle look like in a windowless facility?
Yeah, yeah. No, I love that. And there's, you know, as you said that, what came up for me is, again, from your book, from your talks, when I'm listening and kind of soaking up this, this concept of imposter syndrome, there's a fear. I can speak for myself. There's a fear around owning and accepting my abilities and strengths and skills. There's a fear around that if I do that, then I may come across as arrogant, obnoxious. And I think there's almost an element that I might have to live up to the expectations of what people have said. Because one of the, I don't know how to put this without sounding wanky, but throughout my life, I've been told by a lot of the people around me, like, oh, you're going to do something. You're going to be able to do. And I'm not just talking about your parents believing in you. It's like these weird moments in life where I'd be on stage or and someone like, oh, I'm not worried about you. You're going to do. And I feel like I'm running out of time to prove them right. I feel like I should have been there already or whatever that is. And is that a pattern that you see in people who are around imposter syndrome, who have this kind of fear of not living up to their potential or that they're not as gifted or as good as what people thought they were?
There's a wonderful quote by Linus in the Peanuts cartoon.
Yes, I love that quote. I wrote it down.
I am burdened by a great potential. Because, you know, I think we all know, and one of the ending points I make in my talk, Mark, is that I don't care how much somebody feels like an imposter, that deep down, even you know, and they know that you're no imposter.
Yeah,
and then I can prove it. There was these researchers at Wake Forest University who took a group of students who tested high for imposter feelings, and they said, "How do you think you're going to do on this examination?" And when the students were told no one would see the results, they felt pretty confident. But when they told them we're going to share the results, they lowered their expectations for how well they would do. And the researchers dubbed them phony imposters. And I respectfully disagree. I think what they really uncovered is the flip side of imposterism, which is that deep down, we really do know that we can do just about anything we set our mind to. Not anything. I'm not going to play in the National Basketball League here in the U.S., right? But, you know, as a therapist once said to me, you know, you have what you need to achieve the majority of the goals that you've set for yourself in life. And I remember thinking, that's pretty darn good, right? Maybe not easily, not quickly, not without help, not perfectly, but we know we can do it, whatever it is to us. I think it's just that debris of imposter thinking that gets in our way.
Why do you think we're so afraid of greatness? Why is it? Because I know you quote the same quote that I've quoted in my first book, which was around, you know, it is not our, I forgot what doctors that we're afraid of, it's our greatness. Why is it? Especially that you had a, you know, side note, you didn't choose academia and you ended up going into, you know, marketing. And now you help lots of people with their careers and building business and all that kind of stuff. So you must've been exposed to this. Why are we so afraid of shining, of being who we're meant to be?
You know, I think it's different for different people, but in one way or another, success can separate us from other people. It might make you different than your family of origin, you know, who you grew up with. You know, Pauline Clance, who is one of the co-coiners of the term imposter phenomenon, she and I talked a while back, and she has a PhD, and she grew up in rural West Virginia with tremendous poverty. No one in her family had ever gone to university, never mind gotten a PhD.
PhD, yeah.
You know, and she told me that after her parents had died, a minister in town told her that they were proud of her, right? But they'd never told her that growing up. So when she would go home, she was very different. You know, it can separate you, right? Or you can start making significantly more money. Like for women, if they're in the same field as their male spouse or partner, and they become much more successful, that might cause problems. It might mean relocating. right? Because now you have this promotion and you've got to go to this part of the country or the world where, say, you're a racial minority, there's not a lot of people who look like you or what have you. So, I mean, I think in lots of ways, or maybe you're good friends with people at work and now you get promoted to be their manager. And now you're supposed to hang out with the new level, not with your people that you know, are on your old level. So I think in many ways, success can separate us from other people. I think there's this fear that they're going to expect me to do it again. And I don't know how I did it the first time. So, you know, the question I always invite people to ask is not that proverbial kind of, who do you think you are?
Yeah, I love that.
But
yeah.
Who are you not to, right? That we all have kind of gifts and talents. And let me be clear, we all have blind spots too. You know, I'm a big fan. The new thing I'm talking a lot about now, Mark, is this notion of a humble realist. Somebody who is humble.
Is that the JFK? Is that what JFK said? And or am I confusing?
Yeah, well, he said, what did he say? When Jackie asked him how you describe himself, he said as I think it was an optimist without illusions or something.
Yeah, that's it.
It wasn't an optimist, but it was something like that.
And
so that kind of, got me thinking of being, you know, because you hear a lot about people say imposter syndrome is a good thing. It's our superpower. A lot of people are talking about that because it keeps us humble. I think it's a false choice. You know, I think that the suggestion is you can be an arrogant jerk or you can keep imposter syndrome with all the behaviors and the baggage that goes along with it, all the downside, the cost. And I think that there's a middle path, which is to be a humble realist who does know your skills. It does, like, I'm really good at like three things. I'm okay at four or five things and I suck at everything else. And I'm good with that. Right. You know, I think we have to have not only understand our skills and gifts, but also have a healthy recognition of where we're not very good and our blind spots, you know, and a healthy response to failure, mistakes and constructive criticism. So to me, that's the real goal.
What's an area that you are still working on that, you know, despite all the work you've done, despite all the information, you know, and all the people you've spoken to, this is still a blind spot for you? Like, this is still something that you haven't quite yet ironed out?
You know, it's funny because a lot of things I don't care anymore. And there's so many things I could get better at. I mean, I know you said you're a slow reader. I'm a slow writer. And I'm a slow conceptualizer. So I wrote an article on my blog called Unpacking Michelle Obama's Imposter Syndrome. She was in the UK. She talked at this girls' school, I think in North London, and she talked about that she experienced imposter syndrome. Now, I should have been, it would have been great if I could have had an article out the next day responding to that. The article I wrote probably took me 3 weeks to write. And so I could beat myself up over that, but that's how I conceptualize things. And I'm a slow writer, and I it's like, I'm okay with that. You know, I feel like the older I get, I have a healthy understanding of my limitations, and I'm not like going to run out and how can I write more quickly? How can I connect dots more quickly? I just think this is how I process information, and this is how I write, and it is what it is.
Yeah, I've heard you say this before. Like, with age comes a gift of not caring so much about other people's opinions or what other people think, and you start caring a bit less. And I guess this, you know, full circle back to the start of the conversation. Around,
well, let me be clear. It's not that I don't care what people think. I just want to be clear. It's having, putting things into perspective. I don't know if I told you this earlier, Mark, but I was speaking to this group of healthcare executives in Orlando, several hundred people at this conference, and I started coughing, and I had to step aside, take a sip of water. Came back, asked my audience, how many of you will be mortified right now? A bunch of people raised their hand. I said, yeah, I don't care. And it's not that I would much rather not cough, but I think we take these things way too seriously. And because I know nobody stormed out. Nobody said, I'm not listening to this coughing speaker one more second, right? We've all coughed. Just to kind of move on more quickly is what I'm getting better at. And I'm trying to help other people get better at.
Yeah. And I had, you know, again, confession, because I've been writing my book. And when I started reading your book, I was like, oh, what's the point of me writing my book? You know, like, there's a bunch of stuff that I've been talking about that you mentioned. It's much more eloquent. It's much more research backed. And it's all this stuff. And I feel like that's something that gets in the way of a lot of people. This idea that, and you talk about it, this idea that if I'm not original, then there's no point bothering. You actually, I don't know if you coined this term or if at least you put it forward, the term the crusher,
that's idea. Yeah, Weinstein's work, yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to say a bit more? Because I haven't figured out what mine, but I thought this was so interesting for people to hear a bit more about. Would you mind saying a bit more about this idea? Sure. Like we all have a crusher that appears to be true, but is a lie.
Right. Yeah. Jerry created this whole kind of, it's called education of the self, process for untangling a dysfunctional pattern. And one of the reasons he would say that one of the reasons why we develop these patterns is all the reasons I mentioned, like what did it help you mm-hmm. avoid or protect yeah. you from and so on. Mm-hmm. But one reason we create these patterns is to help us to avoid what he calls the crusher. And the crusher is this kind of hidden negative belief we have ourselves about ourselves. Mm. So let's use a dating example. So the pattern is you keep messing up the first date or coming on too strong or whatever your pattern is that it's screwing up with your opportunity to date effectively. And so the real pattern, the real crusher is that you think you're unlovable. And so you want to kind of speed it up so the other person figures that out more quickly. So you're going to let them know, you're going to be the first one to say it.
You're going to self-sabotage or you know.
Right. So instead of it, yeah. we think, well, I don't want people to think that I'm stupid. The crusher is I think I'm stupid.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. And that if people can think about that, then enables them to see what's the underlying pattern driving a lot of their self-sabotaging behavior or their limiting beliefs or what right. have you.
And let me be clear, yeah. all crushers are lies. I just want to make sure everybody listening understands that they even feel if, like the truth and we might act in ways that reinforce it, mm-hmm. but all crushers are lies.
Yeah, even if someone's going, no, but mine is really true. Mine is no, it's like yours is also like no exceptions. So you I've heard you say this again and again, like you can't talk your way out of imposter syndrome. You know, like you use the example, which I love, which is you can talk about your friends about being, you know, fat, but at the end of the conversation, you don't feel any thinner, which I thought was like such a great line. So if you can't, like someone listening, if you can't talk your way out of imposter syndrome, it's a great first step, right? Talking about it, acknowledging it, maybe sharing an environment where you feel safe. What's the next step? Like, how can we actually do concrete actions towards overcoming? I don't know what the word I'm finding right now, but being with, overcoming, or addressing
your
posture.
Yeah, I'm going to go yeah. with talking yourself down.
Yeah,
faster,
there you go.
Right? So, I think it's the first step is to normalize it, which does involve talking about it. But talking about it in a matter of fact, offhanded, you know, oh, had a huge imposter moment on that podcast the other day. And somebody says, what's that mean? Oh, you never heard of it? It's very common. And explain it without being confessional, right?
Yeah.
But also, I think this topic has been over psychologized. I think we need to do less personalizing and more contextualizing. Okay. And that's why I encourage people to look at the perfectly good reasons why they or others might feel like an imposter. Like, you know, as it turns out, and we discussed this earlier, but being raised by humans makes you much more susceptible to imposter syndrome, right? Because human parents might pass along some messaging or, you know, the school system, teachers, ways people make you feel. So family dynamics might be a part of it. People in certain fields are more vulnerable. People in creative fields, people in information dense, rapidly changing fields, technology, medicine, science, et cetera. Mm. You see a lot of people who experience imposter syndrome. Organizational culture can play a role. You know, there's a reason why imposter syndrome is rampant at universities, not just among students, but also among
male
staff
faculty.
And faculty. As well. And a lot of it has to do with organizational culture. If you're the first generation in your family to go to university, be a, you know, white collar, quote unquote, success. There's not a lot of people who look like you, if you're one of the few women or people of color or person with a disability or the first, right? Because now you got that pressure to kind of represent your entire group. So I want to encourage people to look at like, what are the external factors that contribute to imposter syndromes? And the reason to do that is so when you have a normal imposter moment, I want people to hit the pause button and kind of zoom out and get the bigger view and go, well, of course I feel this way. I'm in medical school. I did an interview with a British medical journal, I think it was. And it was the person doing the podcast, the host and a medical student and a resident. She's like second year out of medical school. And they were lamenting the lack of positive reinforcement in medical school. And the best you can do when the faculty are evaluating you, the best you can do is no concern. Yeah. Like, that's the top, right? That's the best. And I'm like, I'm a realist. So the message I give to them or people in academia is, you know, that sucks, but this is what you signed up for, right? Whether you knew it going in or not, this is the culture. Same thing in academia. When people submit papers to journals, they're peer reviewed. Nobody's writing in the margins, nice paragraph, good point. Like, nobody's saying that. They're only pointing out what's wrong. They're only critiquing it, critical.
Yeah.
So again, I want people to understand the environment they're in so that they don't think it's always about them. And they go, well, of course I feel this way. I'm in tech. I'm never going to keep up. Of course I feel like I don't know everything because I'll never know everything.
Yeah. And you know, as you said that, what I heard so loud and clear was how similar entrepreneurship actually is, because you sign up for it. Like if you go into entrepreneurship, what you sign up for is a world of uncertainty. It's a world of constantly having to make it up as you go along, as to taking on, you know, more bigger projects than you've ever done before. And you keep on having to leveling up. And with that will automatically come feelings of, you know, of inadequacy or feelings of I'm not able to do this. But what we're saying is the difference is going through an experience of a moment versus hanging on to that forever feeling of, oh no, but I'm really winging it. Like every single time that you get validation, I conned them this time. And actually, you've got a sentence. It's a shame. I wanted to pull it out, but I'll just paraphrase it. Well, you say there's a certain level of arrogance that comes with imposter syndrome, whereby you're basically saying that everybody else is almost stupid enough to think that you are good enough. Like you know, was there a sentence like that? Is there something that you say around that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Sometimes when I'm giving a talk, I'll say, I'll pick out my client in the audience and I'll say, so imagine, you know, Sally, you come up to me later and you say, that was great. I really enjoyed that. And I say, oh, really? Wow. Whew. Do you get out of the house much or what? I mean, have you ever seen a professional speaker? And how ridiculous and absurd and arrogant it would sound, right? And because it does assume other people are so stupid, they don't realize we're incompetent.
But it's hard though. Like I hear you say that and I go, I agree with you. And it's so hard. Like, for example, like, you know, my dad is a professional jazz player, was an amazing jazz player. And
so
my brother.
He's always improvising.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and my brother took on the musical gene and is a great guitarist, self-taught himself piano during lockdown, is like an amazing musician. I really struggle with playing music. And I'm going to put a side note here. In your book, there was a golden gem for me, and I want to acknowledge you and thank you for this. You talk about the five different archetypes of competencies or relationship to competencies, which is one of the most plagiarized aspects of your book, which is why we're going to talk about the license that you're rolling out so that people can now be officially licensed to deliver your work. But one of them you talk about is the natural born genius. Now, when I say this to people, they laugh because they think, oh, here we go again. Mark is full of himself, right? Like you think you're a natural born genius. But when I explain to them that, no, my entire life, I thought I was lazy because when something was difficult, I didn't push through. But it wasn't because I was lazy. I'm paraphrasing what you said. It's because I simply didn't see that there was a way from going to A to B, that you're either born A or you're born B. Right. And so I had my entire life just made up that I'm just not that good of a musician.
Right.
And to come back to the original point, which was I played music for the first time to my entire family because it was my son's birthday weekend. And I took the guitar, I sang a little bit. I don't have a great voice, but I can sing okay. And everyone was like, oh, that's amazing. It's so nice to have someone playing music. You play really well. And I kept on going, no, I don't. But it's because it's in comparison to my dad and my brother.
Of course, yeah.
So if you took the guitar, yeah, okay. I don't know. Maybe you're a professional player. I have no idea. But the average person, I'm maybe okay. But compared to my dad, I'm not. So do you see what I'm saying? Like sometimes, I don't know if that's...
Here's the thing. Your dad, compared to other people, is not. So there's always somebody who is better or not. You know, somebody said to me, aren't you afraid when you're out speaking that there's going to be somebody in the audience who knows more about imposter syndrome than you do? And I said, no, maybe I'll learn something. So there's why would you be as good as your dad or your brother? They've been doing it for a long time. So good for you for persevering. Because I identify with you very strongly. When I was like maybe 10, I asked my Uncle Buddy to teach me the guitar. He played the violin, the mandolin, the banjo. So he started teaching me, and that lasted about 10 minutes because I realized, like, I didn't want to learn how to play the guitar.
Yeah.
I wanted to play the guitar.
Yeah.
So I wasn't willing. You know, I have a very low frustration threshold.
Yes.
So I'm not going to, you know, I'd have to be very determined to want to play an instrument, and I'm not. So it's okay.
That's exactly. But also, I realized that in business was the same thing. I was like, why have I not managed to take the business to where I wanted to be? It's because I had not seen that you can either be, I'd not seen that there's a path that as long as you keep at it, you're going to get better.
Yeah, it's all chipping away. Yeah.
I'm conscious of time and I'll be respectful, but there's one point I wanted to bring back to. So just to confirm, research out there kind of talks about that 70% of people have experienced some feelings of imposter. Is that still correct? Is that still?
No, that's what's, you know, that came out of the 1980s, Gail Matthews, and it's just continued to be used. I know there's, you know, there was a study in the UK that found 80% of CEOs and 82% of managing directors said they sometimes feel out of their depth and they're struggling in their role. So, you know, let's just say I think the majority of us
have that feeling. Yeah. And any book you talk about, like, it's not about if you want to stop, you know, feeling like an imposter, you've got to stop thinking like an imposter is kind of a big tagline that you have. I want to do a quick pit stop at TED. Your TED talk was one of the toughest experiences you went through.
Absolutely.
And tell us more about that. Because the same for me, was like one of my most agonizing 6 months of my life, but I'm just want to hear, why was that the case for you?
A few things. One, you would think it'd be easy for me because, you know, I speak a lot, but it had to be 6 minutes. And so I was saying things I'd said many times, but not in that order. I was doing it in front of all TED speakers at TED headquarters. The people in the front row, I could literally like touch them. They were so close. So it was very intense. It was very dark with these very bright lights and big cameras. So it was just a very intense environment. And you could tell, I mean, if you watch that, you go, oh, she did fine. I mean, yeah, I did perfectly fine. But when I walked on stage, I wasn't smiling. And that's because I was so, you know, so anxious. And so, yeah, I mean, practicing it, actually delivering it was incredibly intense. But I mean, if I was going to say what the hardest thing, I would say writing my book was the hardest thing I ever did. I seriously underestimated how long it would take. So like you, and I do the same thing you do. I read someone's book and I go, wow, what a great writer.
Yeah.
Without realizing, at least in my case, that sentence took, you know, 5 days. I had to keep editing. Cause now I'll read it and I go, wow, that sounds pretty good. But I did not just sit there and like, oh, let me just write my book. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so glad you say that. And thank you for saying that because it is the most excruciating thing I'm doing. Like writing is not my natural habitat. Speaking is, and so it's
all
forced
editing, Mark. It's all editing.
That's what everyone says. I heard someone in Bird by Bird, Anne Lamott, I think, is the author. It's a beautiful book. She basically talks about how one of the authors who she loved, said that handing in his draft was half the job, and then the rest is going to be. So quick round of questions for you. One of them is, have you found that introverts are more affected than imposter than the extroverts, or would you say it's about on par?
I don't know. I don't have that research in my head, so I'd have to go take a look at that. Common sense, if I was going to give you my common sense answer, I would say, you know, it is more challenging for introverts because, you know, I think it's a more natural, like not speaking up in a class or a meeting or not sharing your ideas is more natural because you're already an introvert. On the flip side, extroverts, then you could say, well, yeah, but it's just because they like me.
Yeah.
But as I point out, as if likability wasn't a valid skill set.
Yeah. Right? I love, yeah. And there's one of my favorite sentences in your book. And I read this as well when you were talking about the you know, your new program, your licensing program. Can you just say, I want to get the words right, something along the lines of, we need to ditch the old question of what would you do if you had all the money in the world, but rather...
What would you do if confidence wasn't a factor? You know, because the proverbial question is, what would you do if money was no object?
Yeah.
And I would think, you know, what difference could you make in the world if confidence wasn't a factor?
Oh, I love that. Because I love that question much.
We all have these gifts and talents. And when we hold back, everybody loses when bright people play small.
Mm. Oh, that's beautiful. So let's finish with the opportunity of licensing. So I know that this is part of like a legacy almost that you're thinking about. I'm not going to be doing this work forever, but I don't want it to die. And you've now been teaming up and you're launching an initiative, which is effectively to train people in the methodology and the research that you've conducted over the last 4 decades, the experience of sharing with 500,000 of people throughout the world. And you're now making this accessible for people to come and join. Just a couple of minutes, tell us a bit more about why you're excited about this next stage of your, I guess, impact.
Yeah, it really is exciting because, you know, often work does die with the person, and I'm not going to do this forever. So I co-founded Imposter Syndrome Institute with an old friend of mine, Carolyn Herforth, who is also a business strategist. And we are giving people the opportunity. We're trying to create kind of this global cohort of people to help us stamp out imposter syndrome around the world. That's our mission. So we're giving them the opportunity. So basically, here's my Rethinking Imposter Syndrome program. And teaching you how to deliver it, and also preparing you so when you get hit with questions by an audience, you know what to say, so that you can go out and start delivering it to whoever, to corporations, to universities, to associations. At some point, we'll have a coaching program as well for people who don't want to speak, but they want to do executive coaching or one-on-one coaching. But that's the mission. And we had our first group in September with somebody from Chile, South Africa, Belgium, Canada, the US. This time we're going to be able from Australia, hopefully from the UK.
Yeah.
But somehow we become very popular in Australia all of a sudden. So it's very exciting to have so many people around the world be interested in this topic.
Yeah, but especially exciting, I think, after I've read your book, to be able to see how you can take this wisdom and actually partner with other people so they can keep on doing the impact. I think that's really cool. Before we go, I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you for writing a really important book. I know how painful it was to birth this book into the world. But as your friend said, when you were thinking about not finishing your PhD, a lot of people would lose out on not hearing your words. So me included and everybody else, just thank you, because it's a beautiful piece of work. And I'm going to ask you the same question that I ask all my guests and especially the new series of authors I'm interviewing for the research of my book. What does being unconventional mean to you?
Oh, wow. I think it's about kind of following your own road and going back to kind of what do you want your life to look like, and then figuring out kind of how to make that happen. But I'm a big fan of being unconventional, you know, and being, I can't remember his name. I can see him very clearly. He's in the movie now on playing the tennis player's father.
Will Smith.
Will Smith. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Being realistic is the most commonly traveled road to mediocrity.
I know that. I love that quote so much.
Well, somebody asked me in a radio interview, what do you think is the secret to your success? No one had ever asked me that. And the first thing I said was, I don't spend a lot of time in the real world.
Yeah.
And then the interview ended. She's probably thinking,
No, I get that. I get that. That's why I don't watch the news. I used to watch the news 24/7 for my old job, and then I stopped, and I've just become more creative as well. So, Valerie, thank you so much for your time. You. Where's the one place that people can find out more about you if they want to sign up to your newsletter, get in touch to find out more about the licensing program? What's the best place to go?
Yeah, probably the easiest thing is just to go to impostersyndrome.com.
Yeah, one of the strongest web domains I've come across. Your web domain game is strong. Valerie, thank you so much for your time. I so appreciate you.
Thank you. Thanks, Mark.
There you have it, folks. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. It was a genuine honor and pleasure to sit down with Dr. Valerie Young. Again, if you want to get a copy of her book, it's The Secret Thoughts of Successful Women, Why Capable People Suffer from the Imposter Syndrome and How to Thrive in Spite of It. Now, I've told you that I'm writing my book. I'm deep in the trenches. I'm hopefully going to get it over the line in time for my publisher's deadline. But if you'd like to find out a bit more, go over on markdrews.com and join my newsletter. That's markdrews.com/newsletter. And you can join my newsletter where I'll be talking about behind the scenes, sharing some exclusive tips and insights of what I'm learning so far. But there's also an opportunity for you to help me shape my book. And I'm looking for people's stories, anecdotes, case studies. So if you want to join the exclusive VIP tribe, let me know by going over to markdrews.com/newsletter. Join the newsletter, and then you should be getting an email at some point inviting you over. It's good to be back. Feels weird, but at the same time, exciting. 2022 is the year that for me, the word is presence, to be present here, now, with you, with every interaction I have. So I hope that you've come up with your word for 2022. And if you have, let me know. Put your word down in the comments or let me know by replying to one of my emails of my newsletter. I look forward to hearing from you soon. I've got some exciting guests coming up as I'm going to do a special series purely on research for my books. So I'm going to be sharing with you the behind the scenes conversations I'm having with some of the game changers in this space of helping you put yourself out there more, even though you hate it, even though you'd rather hide behind your business and you wish you never had to talk about yourself or your work in public and that people would just flock to do business with you. It's going to be the game changing book that I know it can be, but that's thanks to you to shaping it. So thank you for your help. Thank you for your support. And until next time, keep the fire burning.